It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Clayton Anderson is a veteran of two space flights. He spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station in 2007. He is the one and only astronaut to hail from Nebraska and the first Iowa State University alumnus to become an astronaut. He's written about his life in space and on Earth in the new book, The Ordinary Spaceman, From Boyhood Dreams to Astronaut, and he is with me now. Hello, Clay.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's an honor to be here with you.
Well, let's go back way back in time to 1968 when you say your dream of becoming an astronaut was born. That was Christmas Eve, 1968, watching Apollo 8 on TV. And your parents got you up in the middle of the night so you could watch?
Yes, absolutely. I like how you say when you say, because obviously you know the story. So they awakened my brother and sister and I, plopped us down on the floor in front of a black and white TV, and we watched near midnight, the Apollo 8 astronauts go behind the moon for the first time.
How did you feel watching that?
You know, it's hard to remember back that long, but I do know that I was enamored. I was just transfixed by what was happening. And of course, if you think about what you have today in front of kids on TV and what we had on a black and white TV, obviously to me, it was very much what was going on that was keeping me transfixed. As the flight director was barking out commands to his control team and getting a go-no-go from all the controllers to send those guys behind the rock. It was just very exciting for me. And I knew nothing about what was really going on, right? I just was watching TV.
But you also remember the tension when the astronauts lost contact with ground control.
Yeah, when you fly a spaceship behind a big rock and you're using radio waves to communicate, the rock does not help. So for whatever the time frame was that they were back behind the moon and we just got the static, it was very tense for me. And I wondered if they were being blown out of the sky by a volcano or perhaps a fire-breathing Martian dragon had flown in and blown its flame across them and burned them to a crisp. I had no idea, but I'll tell you one thing, I had an active imagination.
Well, now, as I mentioned, that's when you say your dream of becoming an astronaut was born. Your mom disagreed with you on that front. She said, That's a nice story, but it's not real.
She had a pretty good memory for an old lady, but she reminded me, and she actually told this story on the radio back in Nebraska, that I was 6 years old and that we discussed that I would become an astronaut one day. So much so that in my hometown of Ashland, a very small town between Omaha and Lincoln on Highway 6, every July they had a carnival, a stir up trouble and excitement. And they closed down Main Street and they had bicycle races. They had a street carnival. They had pancake breakfast. They crowned a king and a queen. And then they had a kiddie parade. And of course, all the kids participated in the bike races and the kiddie parade, and we needed costumes, but we had no Walmart, no Costco, no Kmart or Target. So my mother wrapped me in aluminum foil, put one of her hat boxes on my head with the appropriately cut holes, and stuck a pipe cleaner with a styrofoam ball on the top to communicate with the aliens, wrapped everything in aluminum foil, and I marched as a Mercury Gemini astronaut in the parade.
So from whatever point on, you were determined to become an astronaut, and everybody knew that throughout your time in school. Now, when I was growing up, I remember kids talking about becoming an astronaut, and sort of the understood pathway was, well, if that's what you want to do, you go to the Air Force Academy. But that wasn't the pathway that you wanted to take. How did you decide how to pursue that dream?
Well, you know, I actually, as an Iowa State graduate student, I actually drove to Des Moines to the recruiting center down there. At least, I don't know what the name of the place was, but I drove down there in a terrible winter storm on a Saturday morning to take the Air Force qualifying exam. And I remember it well because the exam was pretty easy, at least for me. There were several other people taking the same exam, and it took them quite a long time to finish, but when I ended up talking to the recruiters, you know, my question was, if my eyesight is not good enough to be a pilot, what happens? And they said, well, we'll put you behind a desk for 5 years. And that did not thrill me whatsoever. So I decided that I would forego that opportunity to join the military. And I got an internship opportunity at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. So it all worked out great. But actually, I looked at that path, you know, because I had the same understanding that most did, that in order to become an astronaut, it would be, your odds would be increased if you were a military jet jockey. So,
now you got your undergraduate degree in Nebraska, but you did go to graduate school at Iowa State University in aerospace engineering. You mentioned that internship at NASA, which you did for 2 summers. And then while you were still getting your graduate degree, you got a full-time job offer at NASA and you turned it down. So
Yeah. They don't call me, they don't use my name in the word, in a sentence with the word genius too often. So, you know, at that point in my life, I was done. I wanted to be done with school. I did not want to come to Houston and work for NASA. And as they suggested, earn my master's degree by going to school at night. That just wasn't something that made sense to me or enthralled me at all. So I made a choice. I took a risk, although, you know, I didn't really understand the risk. They said, hey, the government only has certain hiring windows and those windows can close. And as a young kid, I didn't really understand what that meant. I just figured, well, I'll find something else. And fortunately for me, the window remained open long enough that I could graduate from Iowa State and the job offer was still on the table. So, you know, as I tell kids today, anytime you pursue the dream of being an astronaut, there is a little luck involved, and that was one of those lucky things for me.
Well, a little bit of luck. You actually spend a whole chapter talking about how unlikely it is that you became an astronaut or that anybody becomes an astronaut. And once you started working for NASA, that was still your goal, obviously, was to become an astronaut, but it certainly wasn't a sure thing by any means. What is the application process like to become an astronaut?
Well, today it's easier, right? Everybody goes to their laptop of choice and picks their browser of choice and clicks on, I guess it's www.usajobs.gov.
All right, so maybe it's easier to apply. I doubt that it's necessarily easier to become an astronaut. But
yeah.
But you had, once a year, you applied to become an astronaut, right?
Right, right. I tell everybody that it's easy to apply. It's hard to get selected. So I did apply at my earliest opportunity to meet the minimum basic requirements. So I actually applied a little early. I wasn't quite qualified based on job experience, but I took a shot anyway and put in my first application as soon as I thought I was eligible in 83. And of course, it took an application a year. You had to always update your application annually in the event that NASA would select astronauts in that year, and they didn't always select. So for a long time, they selected more frequently until the Challenger accident, and then they slowed down a little bit and picked less frequently. And then Columbia happened, and they even picked even less frequently than that. So in today's world, the selections are at least 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5 years apart. So,
well, and of course, we don't have a space shuttle program in the United States now, so it makes it even more difficult to. Well, we'll talk more about that a little bit later on. But you applied every year, and it took a total of 15 times before your application was actually accepted. And you made it through part of the process one other time before that, the 13th time.
Right.
What kept you going?
Well, I was working for Johnson Space Center in Houston for NASA, where the astronauts lived and trained. So, excuse me, I was where I wanted to be. I had the job I wanted, except for astronaut. And so the opportunity to be at that place and do really cool things for NASA was one of my goals. To be an astronaut was another, but it was kind of frosting on that cake. So during that time, it was simple to continue to work and have fun and do the things I loved, and then try to figure out, the hardest part was trying to figure out how you could enhance your resume to perhaps get the committee to actually look at Clayton Anderson's information. So, you know, I did some of the standard things that people do, right? I got my pilot's license. I learned how to scuba dive. But climbing Mount Kilimanjaro and jumping out airplanes was a little beyond my reach at that time. So, you know, I did what I could. I worked hard at my job and tried to set an example and show the people at NASA who helped select astronauts that I was a good guy. I worked hard. I was smart. I was a team player. I could be a good follower. I could be a good leader. I did my job. I did what was expected of me. You know, those kind of things to establish a reputation, because I hadn't invented anything. I hadn't discovered any new elements. You know, I hadn't sung on The Voice. So,
so once you actually were selected and part of the astronaut program, what happened to you then? I mean, what does that mean? It doesn't obviously mean that you're automatically going into space.
Yeah, that's for sure. We were the class of 1998, my class, group 17, the 17th group ever selected, called the Penguins. We were chosen at a really interesting time in NASA history, in that the 96 class, the Sardines, they had chosen 44 astronauts in total, international and United States. That's a lot. That's a big group. And so when they picked then 32 of us, there was a ton of people waiting to fly into space. It was probably the largest number of astronauts in history. Now, I can't confirm that off the top of my head, but I'm guessing. But you had all those people competing for flight assignments. And so at that time, history said that if you were asked to come to Johnson and be an astronaut, you were in. And you went through a one or two year basic training flow. And then you graduated from an astronaut candidate to an astronaut eligible to fly.
All right, and we'll pick up there in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking this hour with Clayton Anderson. He is a veteran of two space flights. He spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station in 2007. He's just written the new book, The Ordinary Spaceman, From Boyhood Dreams to Astronaut. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Clayton Anderson. He is a veteran of two space flights. He spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station in 2007. He's the one and only astronaut to hail from Nebraska and also the first Iowa State University alumnus to become an astronaut. He's written about his life in the new book, The Ordinary Spaceman, From Boyhood Dreams to Astronaut. And Clay, just before the break, we were talking about once you became a part of that class of astronauts, when you were selected, you went into this training process, and the training process was really extensive. You also went on a mission that would not normally come to mind when people think about astronauts, and that was an underwater mission. And was that part of your training, or was that a scientific experiment?
Well, NEMO, NASA's extreme mission environment, is a lesson in stress. And yes, it's part of our training. So as NASA moved away from the shuttle and toward the space station long duration missions, they needed ways to determine an astronaut's makeup in stressful situations over long periods. So it's really hard to train that in space. It's very expensive to send you up there with no experience. So they looked for ways on Earth that we could supplement that. And NEMO, the Aquarius habitat off of Key Largo, Florida, 62 feet below the surface of the Atlantic Ocean, is one of those places. And it was a great experience where we went down, astronauts, some scientists, and some habitat technicians that controlled Aquarius. We all lived underwater for 2 weeks together as a crew. And that is an analog to living as a crew in outer space, right? An extreme environment beneath the ocean compares reasonably well to an extreme environment way above the ocean.
While you were living on NEMO, you managed to injure yourself kind of seriously. You you sliced your thumb,
yeah,
and you actually had to get stitches. So how did you do that?
Oh, again, genius and Clayton are not used in the same sentence. Although I was trying to be a good engineer, we were building a plastic PVC pipe habitat on the ocean floor. And we went out in teams of two. So Emma Huang, a doctor at NASA, she was out with me, and we were working on it. And the way you put it together was simply you put bolts and nuts through the holes in the PVC, and you screwed them together loosely to build this habitat. Well, whoever had drilled the holes had not drilled the holes big enough for the bolt size that we were being expected to use. So I was getting frustrated, and so I got creative, and I used the PVC pipe cutter, which had a sharp pointy edge, and I would put it in the hole, and I would twist it a few times, and it would bore the hole out a little larger so the bolt would slide through beautifully. And I was rocking and rolling. And then I got so cocky and overconfident, I guess, that on one of the bolts or one of the holes I was messing with, it slipped and it sliced through my thumb. And of course, it cut my thumb such that blood was emanating and there were sharks in the water, which made me a little nervous. And so Emma and I bolted back to the habitat, which required the Aquarius team to invoke their emergency response procedures, maybe for the first time for real forever. And it was quite an exciting day.
And a doctor actually had to come down to you to stitch you up?
Well, you remember what I said about luck. And here's another one of those lucky things. A gentleman named Ken Kamler was scuba diving above the habitat. He was scheduled to interview us from land to us in the habitat the next day. While scuba diving above the habitat, Ken Kamler is also a hand surgeon. So with all those things falling together, they called the emergency response team. They brought his doctor's bag on the emergency response boat out to Dr. Kamler, who then scuba dove down into the habitat and sewed my thumb.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, all right, let's talk about a very difficult experience that you had as an astronaut. And again, this is before you ever went to space, but you were selected to be a family escort for the space shuttle Columbia. And as an astronaut, it was part of your role to be with the families of the crew members who were going up on Columbia. And you write about the liftoff, the takeoff, which was a really intense experience, but then you were also there for what was supposed to be the landing.
Right.
And as all of us remember, on February 1st, 2003, Space Shuttle Columbia burned up on reentry. What was that like for you?
That was a tough day, maybe the toughest day in my entire life. As you stand near the runway at the Kennedy Space Center and you watch your colleagues' families play in the grass, throwing frisbees and chatting and sitting in the bleachers and just living their lives, waiting for their loved ones to come home. And the expectation is that they will arrive just like they always do, at the appropriate time. And then they'll all get together and they'll hug and they'll kiss and they'll, you know, laugh and all the wonderful aspects of reuniting again. We were on the runway waiting for that to happen, and it simply didn't happen. You know, in a shuttle landing, the shuttle creates two sonic booms, one from its nose and one from its tail, which is 122 feet behind. And those are the trademark sounds that the crowd listens for. And when we were standing there and we didn't hear that, my training, even though I hadn't flown in space, my training was had gone enough that I knew what to expect, I knew what to look for, and I remember glancing toward the VIP section, which was separated from the family section by a fence. And NASA security guards in their blue blazers, white shirts, and gray slacks with their big walkie-talkies were standing around in their normal mode of just being protective. And as I looked over at the appropriate time, because I wasn't hearing what I needed to be hearing on the speaker system from the Capcom and the astronauts, one of the security guards raised her walkie-talkie to her ear, and as I watched her, her face went from normal to pale white. And I watched it, you know, I mean, I saw it. And then I looked back to Commander Steve Lindsay, who had flown on the shuttle and who was one of the family escorts as well. And he looked at me and he said two words, and he said, "Get ready." And the feeling in the pit of my stomach was horrible, because I knew what he meant, and nobody knew what had happened, but we knew something was wrong. And that was the start of a really horrible day.
You were there with the families when they learned that their loved ones would not be coming back. And you write about, in particular, the kids who were there, who, you know, mom or dad wasn't going to be coming home. And you're a dad. You have two kids.
Mm-hmm.
Did that experience, which was so difficult, did it make you question your own ambitions? Did it make you think maybe I shouldn't leave my kids behind and go to space?
I think a little. It took a while to focus again on me, because that day led to several months of focusing on others. And like most astronauts, we were ready to do whatever was necessary to help. And if that meant fly the shuttle again, which, you know, that's a pretty healing thing. If a disaster takes your colleagues and crewmates, one way to help heal is to figure out why it happened and fix it and go again. And so I looked at it from that aspect that, you know, and I told my son that, hey, dude, it's going to be safer when I go. So I don't think I ever really considered not going. Having not been assigned yet, it really didn't matter to think that way, right? Because I didn't even have an assignment. So I guess it was in the back of my mind, but we didn't talk about it very much.
Now, speaking of assignment, your first flight was not just a flight. You went up to the International Space Station. You stayed there for 5 months. How did you get selected to be that guy?
Yeah. Well, most of us in my class of astronauts figured that we would end up being assigned on a shuttle flight first, right? It's short. It gets you the experience. It puts your family in the flow of what's required. And then we envisioned that we'd be successful on our short shuttle flight, and then we would be eligible for long duration. But with Columbia happening and a lot of shuffling going on and a lot of delays of shuttles and things like that, the boss called and said, hey, we think that we want to make you a long duration astronaut. We want you to go on the station. And we agreed to do that. My wife and I, my kids were young enough that the trips to Russia and the training and stuff, we thought we could handle. And eventually I was assigned to the STS-118 crew with Commander Scott Kelly, who's now famous for his near year in space. So then, though, a shuttle got damaged and the schedules were delayed and changed again. And so my August 2007 launch was moved up to June 2007. And, you know, my family was caught like, holy cow, that's a lot earlier. And all the parties and all the hotel reservations and all the things that we had scheduled and planned for and all that, it were just totally tossed in the air, because I was going with a new crew with little training with that crew, and I was going to go 2 months early. So our lives were kind of chaotic.
You write about your training in Russia before going to the International Space Station, and in contrasting that with your training in the United States. And the training in Russia sounds like a series of incredible endurance tests.
Yeah, it turns out that way. Some of them are not so expected, but training in Russia, astronauts like to joke with the phrase type 1 and type 2 fun. Type 1 fun is like you're on a roller coaster and you're having a lot of fun right then, and type 2 is where you like can't believe, holy cow, this is horrible. And then when it's over, you go, oh, that was kind of fun, and that makes it type 2 fun. So that was what Russia training was for me. A bunch of those experiences, both in the training facility and outside the training facility when I wasn't even on the clock, you know, cross-country skiing with a Russian dude that flew jets for one of the major airlines, and then running through the woods with a guy who used to train cosmonauts in the early days, you know, as he carried his broken fishing pole to swat dogs, wild dogs, and tree branches. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And that's why I think the book is so much fun, is because the stories are real. And, you know, as people read them, I hope they'll laugh and they'll go, wow.
When you traveled to the International Space Station, your training tried to prepare you for that. Was there any way to actually be prepared for what that was going to be like?
NASA does a very good job of prepping you for everything they can prep you for. But the actual day, the actual process, the actual launch and liftoff, it's very difficult to prepare for that sort of thing. So while I wasn't scared on launch day, I had some anxiety, of course. I was going to be away from my family for at least 5 months. I didn't think about, hey, I'm getting on a big explosive rocket that could, you know, blast me out of the sky forever. You don't think that way. You think that, hey, this is going to be pretty cool, but I really don't know what to expect. So as I walked through crew quarters and got dressed for launch and we had breakfast and all those good things, it's kind of a somber time. You know, there are guys trying to cut some jokes, but most people are pretty focused for what was lying ahead.
And I know part of the preparation for being on the space station with two other men, both Russian, was trying to prepare you mentally. And even before you left, I think the psychologist or psychiatrist that you were talking to said, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tougher than you think it is. Yeah. And then from what you write, it was a lot tougher than you thought it was going to be just mentally to cope with that.
Yeah, there are a lot of highs and lows. And NASA doesn't necessarily give you a lot of mental training, psychological training. I think a lot of times astronauts are expected to go solicit that on their own. And the way you do that is you try to go find people that have done it already and ask them about their experiences. While I wasn't very good or very diligent at going and seeking that information, when I got to space, I was very good at documenting what I was experiencing so I could provide that information to my crew member or my colleagues that were going to fly later. And yeah, there were some difficult times in space. I had a couple really tough ones. I had read the book, now I'm going to forget the name of it, but it's written by a guy named Zimmerman, I think, and it's about space stations, the history of space stations. And he talked about how the Skylabs guys got mad at the ground and quit talking to the ground and basically only did what they absolutely had to because they were so angry and frustrated. Well, I got to that point, and I felt their pain and understood what they were talking about. And then we had another incident that was different but similar in the frustration vein, right? Because you're 250 miles above the Earth in a can with two Russians, and even though they're great guys and great friends and family men themselves, with the cultural difference, it's hard to talk to them about your frustrations and your stresses and your issues. So yeah, there were a couple tough mental stretches for me.
Well, and you had really an amazing amount of contact with home, which I'm sure in most senses makes it a lot easier. But I have a feeling that there's nothing that can make you feel more helpless than to know that your wife is going through a difficult time, or your mom was going through a very difficult time with cancer treatment, and there was absolutely nothing you could do.
Yeah, that was very difficult, specifically with the instance of my mother. Before we launched, she actually had been, they said the spot on her lung had disappeared. So there was a lot of happiness there. I was getting ready to launch into space, and it looked like she was, you know, going to be okay. And then when I got into space and was isolated, I chatted with my wife on the phone system we can use, and she said, hey, it's back. Well, she didn't have to say much more than that, and astronauts are expected oftentimes to be steely-eyed and courageous and brave, and many of them are. Most of them are, I would guess. I don't know about me, though. You know, it was an emotional difficulty for me that I didn't want to share with anybody because I didn't want to burden them and I didn't want to seem like I was a wussy or anything. But, you know, to hold that stuff in and not be able to share it with your crew was a difficult thing. Now, I did have... You do get support from NASA, so we have medical conferences and psychological conferences, and those people were very, very helpful, and I'm really glad that I had them on my side, and even today, we're still close friends because of those exchanges that we were able to have from space.
We're going to take another short break, and when we get back, we'll talk about some of the truly extraordinary things you were able to do in space, and also some of the nuts and bolts reality of what it's like to live in space. Ariel Waldman is going to join the conversation as well. She's just published a book called What's It Like in Space? Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions as well at 866-780-9100. I'm talking with Clayton Anderson. His book is The Ordinary Spaceman, From Boyhood Dreams to Astronaut. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Then the loud sound that seemed to fight came back like a slow voice on a wave of fight. That were no DJ, that was hazy cosmic time. There's a star. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, Clayton Anderson. His book is The Ordinary Spaceman, From Boyhood Dreams to Astronaut. He has flown in space twice. He spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station in 2007. And we're going to talk now about what it's like to live in space. And joining the conversation also is Ariel Waldman. She is a space travel enthusiast, the founder, one of the founders of Science Hack Day, the founder of spacehack.org. She recently published a book called What's It Like in Space? Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There. Hello, Ariel.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. And Clay, you've been there, so we're going to start with you. And in the book, you write about the difficult times on the space station and butting heads with the ground or mission control and some of the hard times. But you constantly remind the readers it was extraordinary. It was magical. It was amazing. So being on the International Space Station, the incredible views that you were able to look at outside those windows, can you describe what that felt like for us?
Sure. First, hi, Ariel. It's nice to be on the radio with you.
Hi.
You know, we're given a privilege to go into space, and that privilege includes the ability to look back at the beautiful planet Earth, and it's a wonderful experience. I don't know that photos and videos and my words will ever describe it. You know, I hope that someday commercial spaceflight is such that many, many humans can go into space and have the same opportunity I had to look at our planet. I think that when you do that, my thought is always it strengthens my faith in God, first of all. But then the second thing is, you know, when nations are working together to put their people in space together, they're not fighting each other on the ground. So I'm honored to have had that privilege to see our beautiful planet from above.
Now, when you give speeches, people love to ask you questions. And Ariel's book is all about answering some of these big questions about what it's like to live in space. And Clay, every time you give a speech, you get the same question. And somebody raises their hand and their cheeks flush. They look a little embarrassed because of what they're about to ask. And you say, ask it anyway. So How did you go to the bathroom on the International Space Station?
Yeah, that's a good one. I went to the bathroom the same way you do on Earth. I just needed a vacuum cleaner.
Okay, elaborate for us a little.
Well, the bathroom on the space station is essentially a Russian design. The bathroom on the shuttle is a U.S. design. Of course, it's irrelevant now that they're all up on blocks. And unfortunately, people can't go in and see that toilet, which would be way cool. But the space station toilet is based on a series of fans and equipment that suck like a vacuum cleaner and pull number one through a tube into a can that's essentially filled with some type of kitty litter material. And then number two is a little more involved in that it requires that you float or sit or whatever above another can that's much like a camping toilet, I guess, with a hole in the top that's not very big compared to what most of us are used to on the ground. And it contains a plastic bag that is sucked by a different fan that pulls the odor and things and inflates the bag enough such that it can catch all the contents. And then you clean up and you push that bag down into the can and put in a new bag for the next person.
If you're nice, right?
If you don't, yeah. We had a couple instances where the bag ops were forgotten by someone, and there were some very angry crew members on board.
So you write about this in great detail in the book, obviously, because it's
too much detail, according to some.
Oh, well, maybe. It's something that people are incredibly curious about. I had a long conversation with my children about it last night, because we don't think about how much gravity helps us out when we use the bathroom.
All right. The separation factor provided by gravity is a wonderful thing, as is indoor plumbing. You know, there are nations in the world that have the separation factor available to them but don't have the indoor plumbing available to them. So that creates in and of itself a big problem. So, you know, and that's one of the cool things about a space toilet is a space toilet and a machine that changes urine into drinking water is going to have great or possibly have great applications to countries on Earth.
Well, and Ariel, this is something that you wrote about in your book as well. So you collected a lot of different stories from astronauts, and you also kind of give us an arc over time. So Clay experienced fairly recent technology in this department, and you write about the fact that a lot of the early male astronauts had leaky spacesuits. They were supposed to keep keep the urine in the spacesuit. What did they find out was going on there?
Yeah, it was really fascinating. I heard this story about how many of the early astronauts they had leaky spacesuits. Essentially, the urine they would have in their spacesuits would sort of leak out. They were using these condom catheters, and they were supposed to contain the urine, and the suits just kept leaking. And so they spent a lot of effort trying to figure out what the design flaw was in these astronaut suits. And what turned out was that when the astronauts were going to their doctors and getting fitted for different things, many of the early male astronauts would go to their doctors, and when the doctor would ask, what size of condom catheter do you need, they would say large. And because of that, they were actually all wearing sizes much too large for them, which was causing the leaking. And so some of it was, harks back to the early, very very male-dominated days of astronauts.
Very interesting.
We'd never do that.
Right. Well, and from what you described, Clay, in the book, I mean, it sounds like you were measured in every way possible. So maybe astronauts don't get to answer those questions themselves anymore. It sounds like modesty was something you really had to let go of in astronaut training and in actually flying.
Yeah, it's a big camping trip, especially on the shuttle where the crew quarters were very small. On the stations, it's a little more voluminous, so it's nicer. But we still use that concept of the condoms in urine collection for experiments. So I can feel the pain of those guys, but no one asked me what size I needed. So I just used whatever was provided, and it seemed to be adequate.
So I would love to talk for just a couple of minutes. Ariel, in your book, you write about how when astronauts return to Earth, getting used to gravity again is a difficult thing for a lot of them. And Clay, you were up there for 5 months and you came back, and I'm sure that it was difficult for you to get used to it in a lot of ways, but your body really rebelled during that transition period from weightlessness to dealing with gravity. What was that like?
Well, for me, for the day I came back from the space station in 5 months, it was a combination of factors. It was gravity, it was fatigue, and it was the fact that I had to go to the bathroom pretty bad. And that was due to a combination of the United States food, which for me just gave me gas, whereas the Russian food was much better from a perspective of regularity. So when I transitioned from about 5 months of Russian food to 2 days of American food, it did not help my intestinal tract, nor did the fact that on landing day we woke up on space time and then got to Earth and had to adjust to Earth time, which made the first day home on Earth extremely long and extremely gravitational.
And Ariel, when you interviewed astronauts and collected these stories, you write about astronauts who drop things because they forget that's how gravity works when they return to Earth. What kinds of things did you hear?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think just about every astronaut has that story of, you know, they'll be, you know, it's a combination of, you know, they'll be brushing their teeth and then they'll just let go of the toothpaste and it'll drop to the floor, which isn't a big deal. But, you know, when you've got like a glass in your hands, you can imagine sometimes that's not nice thing to clean up. But other things are, sort of underestimating how much effort it takes to throw something across the room. So if, you know, you've got a friend saying, oh, hey, toss me that book, they might just like barely throw it over, sort of forgetting that it takes a little bit more effort. But stories like that were always great. And there were even more fascinating stories that came up of astronauts who, when they would return home, they'd wake up believing that they were still floating. So they'd sort of wake up from a deep sleep and sort of think that they were floating above their room. And so gravity, in a sense, is still sort of this broken concept in their minds for some people when they're returning home, and they're imagining that they're still in space even when they're on Earth.
Clay, did you experience that?
I'm not saying, but my wife made me use plastic dishes for 2 weeks.
But you also had the very real challenge of rebuilding muscle tone, because it's just really hard to maintain muscle tone when you're weightless.
Yes, I've been an athlete my entire life, and I think that's an advantage. I worked out really hard, consistently, as an astronaut and as a non-astronaut. But some astronauts, you know, focus more closer toward the mission, but I just did it every day. That's the way I was. And I think that was a big advantage for me, and I worked extremely hard in space, doing a 2.5-hour workout just like they wanted to, maybe more and harder, every single day except one in my 152 days. So I came home, and I was able to recoup and be able to walk and stand in less than 24 hours, but then to be able to run and lift the same amount of weight and those sort of things, it only took me 3 weeks to be released. Mm-hmm. Now, Scott Kelly, who did 340 days, I don't know how hard he worked in space or before, but, you know, he's struggling a little bit, I guess, from listening to his interviews and things with muscles and pain and things like that. So, you know, he was up there longer, but I think the effects are the same. And it takes a lot of hard work, both before you go and when you come back.
Now, earlier in the hour when I mentioned that there's no space shuttle program, you booed. And I know that you've left NASA now. You took early retirement, among other things. You're a distinguished faculty fellow at Iowa State University, which is a really exciting opportunity for a lot of students at Iowa State. But what are your feelings about NASA right now in 2016?
Well, thank you for your kind words. And for NASA, I think they're in an okay place. There's some cool things going on. The issue is budget. In the Apollo days, almost 2 cents on a tax dollar went to the space program. And during my 30-year career at NASA, it had dropped to about 0.7 cents. And today it's less than 0.45 cents on a tax dollar. You know, that's not much. We do some amazing things with that small amount of money. So imagine if the budget could be cranked back up to a couple pennies on a dollar, what we might be able to accomplish. Now, the commercial aspect of spaceflight is good. As we said before, the more people on Earth that can go up and see the planet, the better off we all will be, I believe. But it's going to be dangerous, and the odds and statistics say that one of these, you know, SpaceX, Boeing, Blue Origin, Sierra Nevada, one of these guys, they're going to have an accident along the way. And then the question for me personally becomes, are they going to take their buckets of $1 million and walk away and go do something that's easier, or are they going to stay with it and figure out what went wrong and continue? And then the other question that goes along with that is, and how does that change the market, right? If people got on an airplane with the expectation that the odds were good that they weren't going to land, they might not get on airplanes so much, right? But we've proven over time that air travel is very, very safe and very, very predictable. And that's where space travel needs to go, but it's going to be difficult to get there.
Ariel, I know that you spent a lot of time thinking about space travel in 2016 and thinking about ways that people can get involved. I mean, when Clay was growing up and thought he wanted to be an astronaut, there was one path to becoming an astronaut. What would you say to kids today or adults today who want to get involved in the field of space?
There's absolutely so many opportunities. And I think that's what's really exciting about living today actually, this relates to my own personal story because I don't have a background in science or space. I actually went to art school, but I ended up stumbling into a job at NASA a few years ago. And because of that, I created spacehack.org, which is a directory of ways for anyone to participate in space exploration. So building rovers or discovering galaxies. There are so many different things people can do to actually contribute to the furtherment of space with or without a formal science background. And so I think we live in sort of almost a citizen science renaissance right now. And there are so many great different opportunities for people to get involved. And I think I really love that because as Clayton was saying earlier, that, you know, we need more people and more diversity, really, when it comes to space exploration and having people experience space in a multitude of different ways and people with different backgrounds coming in to contribute. And so actually getting more people involved in space exploration, whether or not they choose that as their main career, I think is a really important thing. And so I think we're seeing a lot of serendipity sort of infused into science today and in space exploration that's really making it better.
Well, and Clay, I'm sure you encounter a lot of young people who want to be astronauts. What do you tell them?
Well, my story is pretty relevant with that regard. Everybody, there are so many that want to be astronauts, but the odds are very difficult. So most of us tell them that you need to figure out what you love to do. And if you love to do it, you'll do it as well or better than anyone. And if you do it as well or better than anyone, then you have a chance to become an astronaut or a JPL space scientist or a great astronaut. I mean, anything, right? But to be an astronaut is going to be more difficult in today's world. Now, like Ariel says, the future, though, is bright with possibilities of people who are not jet jockeys or PhD chemistry engineers or whatever that want to go to space. They're going to have an opportunity, at least I hope they are, if things continue to progress positively and safely.
How do you think spending 5 months in space and in your two trips to space, how did that change you as a person?
It made me appreciate my family even more than I did before. You know, somebody told me, hey, you need to learn about yourself before you go to space. And yeah, I get that. I knew myself pretty well, I think. I didn't realize I would get frustrated so easily. And that comes across in the book, I think, that I tell people of those issues. And it's too bad that I think that some of the things that continue to happen to astronauts in space are the things that happened back in the 60s and 70s. And because of the NASA culture, the space culture, we still do things the same way. Change is hard, and we need to fix that. We need to be able to be open with one another so that we can make it better for all.
Clayton Anderson, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Clayton Anderson, his book is The Ordinary Spaceman, From Boyhood Dreams to Astronaut. And Ariel Waldman, thank you.
Thanks.
Ariel Waldman is the author of the new book, What's It Like in Space? Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.